Hello and welcome to episode one of the Burgess Salmon Pensions Pod, a new fortnightly podcast on pensions news with insights from our practice and tips and tricks for trustees and employers. I'm Chris Brown, a director in the pensions team. I advise trustees and companies on all pensions legal issues. The smallest scheme I'm involved with has about 6 million assets and the largest over a billion, so I do hope this podcast has something for everyone.
And I'm Helen Cracknell, a solicitor in the pensions team, advising pension scheme trustees and companies on a broad range of legal issues. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing contingency planning for if things go wrong, including the tricky question of when it might be right for trustees to take action against the employer.
So here we are at the end of October 2021. Probably the biggest news this month has been on the first of the month, the new regulatory powers and criminal sanctions came into force. And that got Helen and I thinking. So to date, the regulatory powers have mostly been used in insolvency scenarios where things have gone wrong. And that got us thinking, with the new regulatory powers, what can trustees and employers do in the good times to prepare for if things do go downhill with their employer? So I want to introduce our first guest, Mike Dando, a senior associate in the pensions team who specialises in advising on corporate restructuring and scheme funding negotiations involving the pensions regulator. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
So, Mike, have you seen many clients being interested in the new regulatory framework? I guess it's quite easy to focus on all the headlines about criminal offences, but what kind of steps can trustees really be thinking about at this stage?
I think that's right. There's obviously been lots in the press recently about the new Pension Schemes Act and the new powers and sanctions regime to protect pension savers. And of course, that's been driven, or certainly in part, by the high profile business failures such as BHS and Carillion that we've all read about, which put significant numbers of pension benefits at risk. And it goes without saying that from the trustee perspective, additional statutory safeguards for member benefits are, of course, welcome. But whilst there's been a lot of noise about the Pension Schemes Act, I think it remains as important, or perhaps even more important than ever, for trustees to continue to think about the steps that they could themselves take to help safeguard benefits should the need arise.
So what sort of steps are you thinking about, Mike?
Well, that really leads me on to what I would recommend probably as the key takeaway for trustees on this, and that is to know and understand your scheme rules and the powers that you have under them. So, for example, do you have the right to trigger the wind-up of the scheme, either as a general power or on the occurrence of a particular event? So, for example, the non-payment of contributions. Most trustees won't have these powers, but some will.
I think you're right, Mike. Trustees should understand their powers before they ever need to seek to use them. I suppose it's a similar point to looking at the legal covenant. And that's a straightforward and trite point, not a new point, but a question for trustees is, do they really know who is the legal statutory employer and what obligations are there, if any, on entities in the wider group?
Absolutely. And we often get asked to advise trustees on an urgent basis on the powers under their rules and any options available when there are time-critical concerns around the solvency of an employer or its proposed actions. But in those situations, trustees could have been in a position to act more quickly if they'd considered their powers as part of the more business as usual matters for the scheme. And that's particularly the case if there's any ambiguity in the drafting of the rules, which will take time to consider and interpret. So I think it's essentially a recommendation to get prepared and fix the roof while the sun shines.
I think you're so right, Mike. And also another practical step is that trustees could consider training, including training up their own employer. It'd be useful to tell the employer to involve the trustees if they have any business worries, and this could help spot notifiable events, including the new ones to be introduced by the Pension Schemes Act 2021, and also help to consider when activity may have an impact on the pension scheme itself.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And another practical step in being prepared is for trustees to consider their governance procedures and make sure that these are as streamlined and as effective as possible when it comes to decision making.
Yeah, I'd certainly echo that, actually. I've had experience in the last year of having to agree deeds quickly with an employer. This was to allow for deferral of deficit recovery contributions. And trustee governance on one particular scheme was, for historical reasons, not quite as agile as would have been ideal. And we're now looking to introduce more flexibility to decision-making processes so that the trustees can respond more swiftly if they have to again in the future.
That's interesting. And sometimes I think it is only through those type of experiences that these issues do crop up. Hence us trying to highlight the benefits of taking those proactive steps to try and avoid last minute issues.
Yeah.
But of course, it does remain possible that trustees will still find themselves in a situation where enforcement is the appropriate step. And just to step back, when we talk about enforcing liabilities, this could range from a debt due to the scheme as a result of unpaid contributions through to a full Section 75 debt, which I'm sure most of us listening to the pensions podcast will know is the cost of securing member benefits in full by purchasing annuities with an insurer. So I think really against that backdrop, it's clear that circumstances where trustees will need or want to take steps to enforce a debt are likely to be limited. But they are situations that we do see arise.
Thanks, Mike. So I now want to introduce our second guest, Amy McVeigh, a director based in our Edinburgh banking and finance team, who has particular expertise in distressed debt and financing arrangements. Amy, if trustees do need to go about enforcing a debt, how would they go about it?
Thanks, Helen. So the trustee's position will differ depending on whether the debt is secured or unsecured. There are exceptions, and we have seen some of those. In the vast majority of cases, debts due to the scheme will be unsecured, and so the process will be one of debt recovery rather than enforcement of security. One point I just wanted to make really quickly here is that in any discussions and those negotiations around debts that have not been paid to the scheme, trustees should expressly reserve their legal rights in relation to that debt.
Right, so that's interesting. So if trustees are having funding discussions with the employer and are asking the employer to make good, say, contributions due or something, so do you mean that the trustee should use particular legal wording in the correspondence to the employers when they're asking for payment?
Yes. So something as simple as, you know, this correspondence is without prejudice to our rights in relation to the debt, this due. Something as simple and as straightforward as that, but I suppose tonally in keeping with the correspondence. To make sure that, again, there's no suggestion at a later date that the nature or the timing or the amount of what is due.
Yeah, okay. Fab, that makes sense. Sorry, Amy, I interrupted you there. So what if those discussions don't get anywhere? How do you then go about looking to enforce?
So if that consensual solution really isn't possible, and again, that's when you get to full exhaustion of correspondence, then the first formal step is for the trustees to issue a short demand for the sums that are due.
Amy, just for the benefit of our listeners, and myself included, is this a statutory demand that you're referring to?
Here, what I'm more referring to is a simple short form demand, which really signals to the employer that change in emphasis, you know, that period of negotiation has concluded and has been exhausted, and actually the discussions really need to be more focused if they are able to continue. So if the employer doesn't make payment following the demand and it's in the interest of the scheme to do so, then the trustees can really seek to establish the debt due to them by going down the statutory demand route. So again, there is a bit of replication here, or repetition, in terms of the content. So you're taking what you've already said and you're putting onto a much more formal footing and issuing it again. But as I said, the difference in that is that the statutory demand can then find further formal process. I suppose from a relationship perspective, because we can't entirely lose sight of the fact that there will have been a longer term relationship between the parties here. It again emphasises that there's been a tonal change in discussions. So from something very short form that maybe comes on heavy paper to something that's a longer form, more formal document, and again, needs to be really taken seriously by the employer on receipt. So I've referenced the formal, further formal process and issuing the statutory demand in that regard. So the issuing of a stat demand is one of the options for an employer constituting a legal, and it is a technical legal definition of the employer's inability to pay its debts. And that's really important for a third and final step if payment is still not received on the back of that. Now, the statutory demand is only one option, And the other option is to go down the court route, and that applies Scotland, England and Wales, and establish the debt that's due to the scheme by way of a court action. But in either case, if either at the end of the court action, when a decree or judgment is passed in favour of the scheme, or following service of a stamp demand, if payment is still not made, then the trustees can choose to proceed to the third step and petition for the liquidation or winding up of the employer. What I would say in that, and again I'm repeating myself slightly, is that that's a very, very serious step. This third step involves the appointment of an insolvency practitioner as liquidator and the corporate death of the employer entity. It really is endgame, and I think the trustees need to be aware and need to be very cognizant of the interests in the scheme here, and whether it is in everyone's interests, including the schemes, to proceed to that third step.
And Amy, it's probably worth adding there, from the pensions perspective, that insolvency would then be the statutory trigger for a Section 75 debt on the employer immediately becoming due. So trustees will want to have considered whether forcing an insolvency is likely to be in members' best interests when compared to allowing the employer to continue. And in reaching that conclusion, case law is clear that the trustees shouldn't take into account the compensation provided by the PPF pension lifeboat.
Amy, just to lean on your expertise, are there any differences in how you go about enforcing a debt in Scotland when compared to England?
That's a good question, Helen. In Scotland, it's necessary for a qualified insolvency practitioner to be appointed as liquidator. A couple of other differences to flag: the fees involved in formal process north and south of the border will be different. There are some technical differences around about the timing of service and advertisement if a winding up petition has been filed. And the requirement for a hearing, actually, so in England and Wales there'll be a hearing regardless of whether or not the petition is opposed. But in Scotland, if the employer doesn't lodge any defences, then no hearing will be required. So actually, potentially a bit more work on at the earlier stage in order to track down an insolvency practitioner, but also potentially a bit less process later on, depending on the response to the petition itself.
Okay, Brill, thanks, Amy. Helen, I know we had one other question for Amy.
Yeah, so slightly different tangent, Amy, but we know that you're based in Burgess Hammond's Edinburgh office, which has just celebrated its second anniversary. I visited it once, actually, while attending the Edinburgh APL conference, so I know what it looks like. But can you tell us what it's actually like to work there?
Great question. Thank you. We're so pleased and proud of the office. We're so happy with how ambitious and how collaborative it is, and really how well we in Edinburgh have integrated with our colleagues in Bristol and London. And actually, as much as there has not been an ability to travel between the offices, obviously over the last wee while, technology has been a great help in all of that. And actually, I think we've all worked together very, very well over the period, over all of the over Teams and other platforms. We have a really great team in situ. We're continually growing in headcount, and we have expertise spanning a range of sectors, including financial services, energy and real estate. So it's a really exciting place to be. We're absolutely thrilled with how the last two and a half years now has gone, and we're really looking forward to the years to come.
Super. Yeah, thanks, Amy. And on the collaboration, I mean, you and I have been working together very closely, looking at enforcement options for a particular trustee client recently. So I can attest to that. And I'd add that I've been learning a whole new language with the Scots law terms for various bits of the courts process that are totally new to me as an England and Wales qualified lawyer. So Mike and Amy, if we are to leave our listeners with just a few takeaways, what would they be? And Mike, over to you first, I think.
I think from me, and to distill it down, Chris, it's really a message of get prepared. So the points we discussed, so know your scheme rules and any specific or unusual powers under them that could allow trustees to trigger a debt or help persuade corporate behaviour in negotiations. And also check if there's any ambiguity in the drafting of those relevant rules that may take some time to resolve. If you can, streamline your governance procedures as far as possible so that you're in a position to act quickly if needed. And I think just don't leave it until you're facing an urgent issue to think about these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd echo that. And Amy?
For me, it is, I think, be aware that when we get into enforcement, it's serious territory. And I know that sounds like a bit of a silly point here, but potentially the ramifications of following through the steps that we've talked about here are catastrophic for the employer. Mm. You know, we are talking about endgame and we are talking about corporate death. And that's your ultimate point.
Yeah, absolutely, Amy. And I would certainly echo that from, my experience of us working together on a matter where all of this is relevant for trustees at the moment. So thank you, Mike and Amy, for joining us today. It's been a really interesting discussion.
Thank you for listening to the Burgess Salmon Pensions Pod. If you'd like to know more about our pensions team and how our experts can work with you, you can contact myself, Chris, or any of our team via our website. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy listening to our next episode, which will cover the Pension Schemes Act 2021 and what trustees and employers need to know about approaching corporate transactions. This will be available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, and thanks for listening.